Well, when criminal cases go to court, we often rely on forensic evidence to determine guilt and innocence. Forensic evidence also very important to the criminal justice system before cases get to court in the first place. DNA testing, fingerprints, hair analysis, there's a whole lot of different forms of forensic evidence, but how reliable are those techniques? A Duke law professor, Brandon Garrett, has just written a book called Autopsy of a Crime Lab, which argues that the reliability of those techniques has not necessarily been fully tested as much as we think it does. And on the occasions when it has been tested, they're often not as reliable as we assume they are. That book's out now, and Brandon Garrett joins us on the phone to talk about it. Brandon, thank you so much for being with us today. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what is the upshot of the book? You've been in this field for a long time. You've worked with the Innocence Project on a lot of specific cases that have dealt with the reliability of forensic evidence. What don't we know and what should we know?
Yeah, I've worked with groups like the Innocence Project, and I've worked with crime labs that are trying to improve their procedures, and worked on principles for policing, because it's really a problem from whether it's police officers at the crime scene or what happens in the lab or what happens in the courtroom. There are ways that forensics can go wrong each step of the way, but that's not what we all think. We all watch CSI shows, and prosecutors used to talk about a CSI effect, but the real CSI effect that I've seen in doing research is that people figure like it's high tech, it's a match, it's an expert, and so it must be perfect. And that's what the experts used to say in court. They used to say, actually, this is 100% identification. There's a zero possibility of error. This is a perfect match. And we all know, like, if we think about it, that there's no such thing as a perfect, infallible expert that never makes mistakes. And any human technique has uncertainty. But that's not the way we've been told about it for decades. And judges have let it in. And we're starting to sort of pay the costs. In terms of scandals and cases being reopened. Massachusetts just announced another 75,000 drug cases being reopened. And so this sort of brewing national scandal surrounding forensics really needs to end, and we don't really have an end in sight quite yet.
I know the Innocence Project is in a lot of high profile or a lot of publicity by dealing with death penalty cases and people who have been on death row oftentimes for decades on really faulty evidence. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, the criminal justice system has million plus cases every single year that don't involve the death penalty, and forensic evidence is involved in all of those as well. What are some of the key statistics that you've uncovered?
Yeah, so there are a lot of low-level cases that people don't think about much. Cases just like in North Carolina, sometimes officers use like a field drug testing kit. They're not very accurate. They're supposed to follow it up with a lab test that is accurate, but often they don't, or the person will just plead guilty. A lot of misdemeanors, a whole group of hundreds of misdemeanor cases in Houston, for example, where people pleaded guilty and it turns out the kits weren't accurate, the stuff wasn't drugs, but rather than go to the jail, people pleaded. And so, right now they're opening up another 75,000 cases in Massachusetts. We know about hundreds of thousands of cases that have been reopened based on flawed forensics, but those are just the audits that have happened, the labs that have been closed. For the most part, we have no idea. What we do know is that when you test some of these forensic experts who come into court and say, based on my experience, my training, I'm good at finding a match, I can find an identification when I see enough stuff that the prints or the firearms or the tool marks have in common. When we test these experts to find out how good they are at being an expert, their rates are shockingly high, and not like one in many, many millions or billions like people assume when they think of like unique fingerprints. And so we need to know a lot more, because in real cases, the evidence is often from a crime scene is smudged, partial, messy. It's not like a beautifully rolled fingerprint on a nice pad of paper. And whenever you have vague evidence, the kind of biases and the pressure from law enforcement can cause horrible errors to happen.
And sometimes just the nature of the criminal justice institution, too. I mean, I had a chance to read the book earlier this week, and one of the most kind of striking stories that stood out to me was the case of, I think this was back in the 19, or probably earlier than the 70s, actually, a court case where a judge for one kind of one-off case allowed analysis of bite marks because the defendant had a really unique facial structure that made the bite marks a relevant piece of evidence in that particular case. But now the precedent's been set. So judges all over the place are introducing bite mark evidence as well, just because that's how the court system works.
Yeah, that was a classic example of how courts work. It was a case where there was a human bite mark, which it's not like that happens every day, and it's often hard to tell whether like bruises on someone's body or a human bite or insects or just a bruise. If you've ever had kids bite you, and I had kids go through a biting phase, like, you know, like skin doesn't show bite marks real well. It just kind of looks red and then it goes away. But there's a one case in California where the victim was bitten on the nose, and these two dentists said, look, you normally can't tell anything from bite marks, but these markings were so clear because of the unusual surface that was bitten. And the judge in that case said, well, okay, just for these purposes, we'll let it in. But those dentists were very clear that this is not something you would normally do. Like, this is not, we have no idea how reliable this is in general. But courts around the country all of a sudden looked at that case and said, oh, there's a case we can cite. We'll let it in too. And lo and behold, you know, decades later, we've had over 24 people exonerated who are falsely convicted based on bite mark evidence, because to this day we have what little we know suggests that that technique is horribly unreliable.
Speaking with Brandon Garrett, again, Duke Law professor, author of a new book called Autopsy of a Crime Lab, which is out now. And we're speaking about the fallibility of expert testimony and the fallibility of just institutions like the criminal justice system in this particular context. But I'm reading this book, and it raises kind of that same question about just the fallibility of experts in general and the fallibility of institutions in general. We're talking of people, and this is not just the criminal justice system. It's you and me as well, too. Every time I turn on the microphone, I am positioning myself as an expert. People ask me if I ever mess up on the air. I say, well, I mess up 6 times before the first commercial break. You just got to be aware of that. And the same thing with the book publishing process. I was kind of amused. I was reading the book earlier this week, and I stumbled upon a factual error in the book, which made it through the entire vetting process and the publishing process. And I mean, it's just the case that institutions
you'll
are fallible.
You'll have to tell me what that was later.
I will. But what does this say about
we all make mistakes. You know, lawyers make mistakes. I think there is a difference between me writing a book with a typo, or you saying something that you didn't mean on the air, and you know, you can correct it later. Lawyers, I believe in expertise. You know, I'm a law professor. I'm training my students to be good lawyers and to have good professional judgment. But there's a difference if you're saying on the air, like, these are interesting questions to ask a viewer. In my professional judgment, you know, this is what's going on in the news. Or a lawyer saying, in my professional judgment, you know, I'm telling you that if you sue, your chances are not good. I can't promise you you'll lose. You know, I'll try the best I can to represent you. You're offering judgment. What these experts have been doing in forensics and in criminal cases has been going into court. They're not saying, based on my judgment, you know, there are a lot of similarities between those prints. They're saying 100% certain it's a source identification. Mm-hmm. They've changed their language a little bit, but they're basically saying, you know, unequivocal conclusions, categorical conclusions, up or down, hit, miss. And that's not how science works, right? Science is supposed to be probabilistic with measures of uncertainty. You're supposed to test experts. And so for someone to be just like a self-proclaimed expert that isn't tested but is offering a conclusion about a probability, that's not okay. It would be okay if you weren't offering probabilities, if you were just saying, you know, I've read these historical books and I'm a historian and I can give you my sense based on historical documents. But if you're saying something precise, this came from that, then you need to be tested. And, you know, we should all be skeptical of experts who haven't been tested. We would, if it was an astrologer saying that they could predict the future, we would want to test them. You know, if it was a courtroom translator, we would say, well, we want to know whether this person is actually translating from Russian. Like, we want to test them. And we'd expect our courts to hold experts to a really high standard because of the aura that an expert has on the stand. And that's just not what judges have traditionally done.
Yeah, speaking with Brandon Garrett again, Autopsy of a Crime Lab is the title of the book. So getting back to the courtroom and the criminal justice system, how do we improve the situation? What's necessary to get to a better place where we can trust expert testimony to the extent that we can?
Yeah. Well, we've been through scandals with the crime lab here in North Carolina, and there have been some good changes made here in the state. There's been for several years a new rule, a reliability rule, the state rules of evidence, Rule 702. Many states have done this. If judges were really rigorously following it, they would be insisting that evidence be reliable before allowing someone to testify about it as an expert, and they would be looking carefully at how reliably the expert applied their method. Courts haven't tended to apply the rule that rigorously in criminal cases, but they could. We also need to regulate the crime labs and provide them the resources to do real quality control. They often don't have the resources, and they aren't doing the kind of testing to make sure that their experts are doing good tests that we would, that would be standard at any hospital, any clinical laboratory. You know, the kind of quality control you have when you get a strep test is just leagues ahead of what happens if they're testing drugs or they're testing fingerprints or they're testing firearms. And we need to require it, but we also need to provide labs with the resources to do it right.
The book is Autopsy of a Crime Lab. It's out now. Brandon Garrett, Duke University Law, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was a treat.